From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we call Qatar to talk with journalist Hampton Sides, who is reporting on Central Command. He was training to be an embedded reporter, preparing to travel with the Marines, but at the last minute, while learning how to use his gas mask and chemical warfare suit, he had second thoughts and backed out. We'll talk with him about why and hear about what life is like at Central Command in Qatar, where public opinion is against the war. Hampton Sides is also the author of the book Ghost Soldiers, about the Bataan Death March of World War II. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. Pentagon officials say U.S. and British forces are now targeting Iraq's elite Republican Guard troops on approaches to Baghdad. And as the Iraqi capital was pounded for a fifth day from the air, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz took to the airwaves to insist that the leaders of his country remain in control. NPR's Anne Garrow says Aziz addressed his message to the American people.
He warned the American people that the American government was getting it into a quagmire. He said American troops were only fighting ordinary Iraqi forces at this point, forces he said Americans had dismissed as not very good. He said they'll see, you know, the real thing when they meet the Republican Guard later.
NPR's Anne Garrels in Baghdad. Iraqi television is broadcasting video of what Iraq says are two captured American crew members from an Apache helicopter that went down on Sunday. Washington Post correspondent Anthony Shadid reports from Baghdad.
About 9 p.m., Iraqi television showed footage of what it said were two U.S. soldiers. They were the pilots of an Apache helicopter that the government said was brought down by an Iraqi farmer firing an old Czech rifle. They also showed footage of the helicopter itself. It was laying on its belly on a grass field. It looked pretty much undamaged, and it was unclear how the farmer's gun would have brought the helicopter down. When television showed footage of the two soldiers, there was no sound with it, so they weren't audible. But it did linger on their images for a while, and it also showed credit cards and identification that appeared to have been taken from their wallets.
Washington Post correspondent Anthony Shadid in Baghdad. The top U.S. general in the war in Iraq says a two-man Apache helicopter is missing, but he denies Iraqi claims that the chopper was brought down by enemy fire. U.S. troops wounded in battle in Iraq have been flown to an American base in Germany for treatment. NPR's Emily Harris has this report.
A dozen U.S. troops are now receiving treatment at an American medical center in southwest Germany. Eight were injured in combat, six Marines, and two soldiers. Medical personnel say most of the injuries are blast-related, but did not give any further battlefield details. Four other troops were flown in with non-combat injuries. All 12 are expected to recover and return to duty, although not soon, according to a military official who says all will likely spend time in the U.S. for treatment or rehabilitation. Almost 2,000 troops have been treated at this hospital since October 2001, when U.S. military action in Afghanistan began. The staff is trained to treat a wide range of battlefield injuries, including from chemical or biological weapons. Emily Harris, NPR News, Berlin.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials fell more than 300 points in trading Monday. This is NPR News. The FBI and the Arab American community are asking for the public's help in locating suspected terrorist Adnan El-Shukri Juma, a Saudi-born man whose last known address was in the Miami area. The FBI says Shukri Juma may be using passports from several countries, including Guyana, Canada, and Trinidad. The head of the FBI's South Florida office says El-Shukri Juma has been identified by senior members of the Al-Qaeda organization as a serious threat to the United States and abroad. U.S. officials recently said they are looking into El-Shukri Juma's possible links to Jose Padilla, a South Florida man who was arrested last year for allegedly plotting a bombing using a radioactive device. The second of six Buffalo area men accused of supporting the Al-Qaeda terrorist group has pleaded guilty to federal charges. From member station WBFO, Joyce Kryzak has more.
The six Yemeni Americans were charged last fall with providing material support to a known terrorist organization. Shafal Mossad is the second of the so-called Lackawanna Six, who now admits he attended an al-Qaeda training camp months before 9/11. Co-defendant Faisal Ghalib pled guilty to similar charges in January. Both have agreed to waive jury trials and, if necessary, to testify against the remaining four suspects. U.S. Attorney Michael Battle says there could be additional plea deals coming.
We have received permission from the Justice Department to engage in plea negotiations. At this time, that rests with their counsel.
Mossad faces 8 years in prison and a fine of up to $150,000 when he's sentenced on July 16th. For NPR News in Buffalo, I'm Joyce Kryzak.
And I'm Shay Stevens, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Embedded journalists traveling with the military are bringing us extraordinary reports from the battlefield, and they're risking their lives to do it. My guest, Hampton Sides, was almost one of them, but at the last minute, he had second thoughts and backed out. He explained why in an article published in The New Yorker's March 24th edition. Now he's in Doha, Qatar, covering Central Command. Sides is a contributor to the online magazine Slate and is also writing for Men's Journal. He's the author of the World War II book, Ghost Soldiers, about the Bataan Death March. Earlier today, we called Hampton Sides in Qatar to talk about covering Central Command, life in Qatar, where public opinion is against the war, and his decision not to travel with the military. Was there a specific moment when you said to yourself, that's it, I can't go through with this, I'm not going to be an embedded reporter?
Yeah, I had doubts all week about it, but I think that the moment for me was when there was a fairly vivid discussion about what would happen if you were to throw up in your gas mask, with your gas mask on. And the question was raised. It was actually a serious question because nausea is one of the first symptoms of some of these chemical agent attacks. And the young instructor who was giving us this tutorial clearly had never visited that question before. It was sort of a fine point that he had not considered. He taught us, tried to imagine. Well, he showed where the clear valve was, where you should blow out. If you throw up, you would blow it out of this valve. And I was just, I had my gas mask on. I was listening to this conversation. I was looking at all of us soon to be embedded journalists out there on the tennis court at the Hilton in Kuwait City. And I said, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I'm gonna be competent enough to with my equipment in case something were to happen. I think that was really the moment for me.
Did you feel like, but I have to go through with it, otherwise I'll be a coward?
Definitely. I think there was there is about the embed process. There was kind of a macho peer pressure. Most of us were guys, and many of us were, very, seasoned, hardened war correspondents, or what I might call military hardware geeks, people who live and breathe this stuff. And we were, there was a forward momentum as we, as the days wound down, and it was about time to embed. Of course, we're going to go through with this. We all had our doubts. We all were scared. There was endless articles in the Kuwait newspaper about all the things that we thought Saddam had to throw our way. We kind of spooked each other out at night, telling biochemical ghost stories. So yes, I think we were all scared, but there was a pressure to go ahead with this at all costs. I fully intended to do it right up until the very, very end. It was really the last night before the buses were going to come take us away that I looked myself in the mirror and I said, I don't need this. I don't have to do this. I'll turn in my chem suit and try to cover this war in some other way.
Did you tell any of your friends who were also going through this embed training process that you were leaving, and what kind of reaction did you get?
Yeah, that morning I did. Two guys in particular who became buddies of mine. And, I did expect a kind of a... you know, like you wimped out kind of thing. And in fact, the reaction was just they totally understood. I think they were maybe perhaps a little bit envious of me, but they understood that this is a decision that everybody has to make in their gut, and they have to go with it. And once you do make that decision, you can't look back. And really, I don't know if it was the right decision or the wrong decision, but I know that it was the right decision for me at that time, and I haven't looked back. You know, that there is a kind of curious dynamic to this war, which is that, you know, we're trying to prove to the world that Saddam Hussein has these weapons. We want him to have these weapons. He better have these weapons, or else in some ways it invalidates the stated purposes of the war. And we would have to have good reason to believe that if he has these weapons, he would use them. And so I kind of went into this feeling like not only was I not quite sufficiently prepared, you know, in terms of just dealing with my equipment, but also I kind of felt like the embedded reporters were kind of like lab rats, you know, going into an experience, an experiment, a chemical experiment. We just don't know what's going to happen, and let's hope nothing does happen. But as they get closer to Baghdad, I think there is a great fear that God forbid, the unthinkable will happen.
You said you had other doubts, too, all week during your training process. What were some of your other doubts?
I wasn't sure what the embedded process was really going to be like. You know, I know that I think it still remains to be seen, you know, what's going to happen in terms of the quality of the reporting. We've seen some very vivid footage of live battle scenes, and I think overall the reporters have been given a lot of latitude to report pretty much what they're seeing. But you know, I had some doubts about what embedding, how was this going to limit my experience, you get embedded with one unit and you are necessarily constrained by, you know, by that one very limited vantage point. So I guess I was somewhat concerned about that, and I was also concerned about the fact that I was given the arguably the most dangerous embed slot on the battlefield, and this is purely by luck of the draw. I didn't know about it till I got to Kuwait, and they said, "Well, you're going to be with 1st Recon of the 1st Marines," and recon is by definition, you know, the eyes and ears of the Marines, and the Marines are, as you've seen, I think, front and center in all the battles of southern Iraq already. They've been everywhere, and I think that influenced my decision as well. I mean, I if this had been a different slot, and there's so many, I mean, hundreds of embedded slots, and some of the slots, of course, are actually quite dull and quite boring. I talked to one guy who was going to be with something like the 313th Support Wing, which is involved with moving supplies around, and he said he was going to write the definitive MRE story. You know, trying to put the best face on what was essentially a dull slot.
But a supply convoy was ambushed. I mean, that could be pretty dangerous too.
Yeah, I think that illustrates another point that, you know, in this kind of ground war, there are no safe, quote unquote, safe or unsafe slots. I mean, it's a very fluid battlefield. The lines are not clean. There are these enclaves, and there, you know, also, you know, pockets of resistance all up and down the battlefield. So in a way, no one is safe. And luckily, so far, nothing has happened to any of the embedded journalists. There have been, unfortunately, some unilateral journalists who have been killed or are missing, as you know. But, I'm crossing my fingers and just, you know, hope and pray that nothing happens to these guys.
What kind of journalistic guidelines were you given during your training about what you'd be able to reveal and what you wouldn't be able to reveal?
We had to sign some ground rules, which, if you read them, were fairly, they all made sense. I mean, they really had to do with, especially with reporters who were broadcasting live from a battlefield. These most of the restrictions would not have applied to me because I was writing a magazine piece that would have been published a month or so down the line. So the real concern was giving away information that the enemy could use, and it would jeopardize the safety of the soldiers. The unit commander always had control over, you know, when you could file, and, you know, if you were in the heat of battle, you had to get the consent of the unit commander if the situation was not safe. And there were some other restrictions that had to do with the use of lights. Television crews are not allowed to use light at nighttime situations where they feel like they're in danger. Most of the ground rules were actually quite commonsensical, and as far as I know, no one has violated or even attempted to violate those ground rules.
And what about protection? Were you expected to be protecting yourself, or were you supposed to get any protection from the unit that you would have been traveling with?
The one thing, part of the rules of the embed process were that you are not allowed to carry or use a weapon. You're not allowed to protect yourself. You are fully, you're protected by your unit that you are embedded with. And, I think that it would have been viewed as a very bad PR situation if one of these embedded journalists were to get hurt or, God forbid, killed. And so, you know, I did feel that the Marines, in my case, would have taken care of me to the extent possible. We had to provide our own flak jacket and our own helmet, our Kevlar helmet, and, we were presumably going to be kept back a little bit from the action. But again, as we've seen, the action is all around. It's in pockets all over the place, and it's impossible to assure the safety of a journalist, if you think that, you could just be held back a ways from the front lines.
My guest is journalist Hampton Sides. He's in Qatar, where he's covering Central Command. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, Hampton Sides is joining us by phone from Qatar. He's a journalist who had planned to become an embedded journalist, but at the last minute, during some of the germ warfare training, he decided to back out. So the unit that you would have been embedded with, had you decided to stay with that, was the Marine First Recon Division. Have you been keeping up with that unit that you would have been embedded with?
Only in bits and pieces. It's hard for me to keep up with them personally. I don't have any mode of communication, but they've cropped up. I mean, the first recon cropped up in news stories, and certainly the first Marines are everywhere. I mean, practically every major firefight or a pocket of resistance has ended up involving the first Marine. So. They're very much in the thick of things, as I was told they would be, and I'm not surprised.
You were going to be covering the Marines, who have a reputation for being really strong, tough, macho. How did they see you as a reporter? Were you considered like a different species, or?
Well, they have been told that this embed thing was an important, an experiment, basically, and that it had to work, and they all around the Hilton. I mean, you understand, I didn't actually go to camp out with them. I was, the buses were literally leaving that morning mm-hmm. when I decided I couldn't go through with this. And but all the Marines around the Hilton, all the public affairs officers, all the various representatives were just very, they did kind of look at us a little different. I think there was a little mutual sizing each other up. There's always been a level of, I'd say, mutual distrust between journalists and the military, but at the same time, this is a whole new ball game. This embed thing is an experiment, and it seems to be working. And they were, I think, bending over backwards to be nice to us as they told us these chemical stories. And as we got our shots, I got my anthrax shot and my smallpox vaccination. And, the Marines were right there with us, kind of coaching us along.
And would it be fair to say that this allowed you to see the military in a way different from how you'd seen the military before?
I'd say yes. What I need to say here. When I made the decision not to embed, it was at a critical point because the buses were literally leaving to take us away to camp out with these guys and to be with them finally after much talk, and that's when I knew that I knew this was the moment. This was the moment where I had to decide, because if I came under their care, if I started eating their food, if I started camping out with them, I knew that I was going to become good friends with them. I love talking to soldiers. I have written a book about soldiers in World War II. I knew that it would be almost impossible for me to leave at that point. And if I were going to hold my head up high and make this decision, this was the moment before the buses left. And, it was really critical for me to make that decision when I did.
Do you think the dynamic of getting very close to the soldiers that the journalists are covering and eating the military's food and traveling with the military will affect their coverage, will affect the kind of journalistic distance that you expect from journalists?
Yeah, they talk about what they call the Stockholm syndrome, or the military version of that. This idea that you come to sort of identify with the guys that you're with in a situation like this, and I'm sure to a certain extent that is inevitable. And there's another component of that, and that is that these guys are literally defending your life. I mean, your life is dependent upon them, and so you. You know, it will be difficult, I think, for journalists to be entirely objective. I think, it's better than what we had in the first Persian Gulf War, where we essentially didn't have this type of proximity. But at the same time, yes, I think it will be hard. Objectivity will be hard because, you will become, over time, essentially a member of the Marines. It's going to be hard to say something critical about, if something critical is called for, about a person that you've been camping with and who you've come to kind of feel that you owe your life to. That is difficult in a way, and that's something that certainly occurred to me when I accepted this assignment.
I think sometimes in war that imagination can be your enemy, because you can vividly imagine all kinds of ways of getting captured and tortured and killed and gassed and
Absolutely.
So on. And this could be your enemy. You don't want to be thinking about that. You're not only a writer who uses your imagination as part of your work, but you also wrote a book about called Ghost Soldiers, which was in part about the Bataan Death March, a march during World War II in which Americans taken prisoner of war by Japanese were marched for hundreds of miles, and the men who dropped during that march were either killed or left to die. It's a horrible episode of war history, which probably could only make your imagination even worse. And I'm wondering if writing that book was almost a liability in preparing to be an embedded reporter.
It's possible, because I certainly did not, when I went into this...
Let me stop by saying, because you had all the imagination from writing this, but you never kind of experienced it. Sometimes experiencing it can, exercise some of those fears because you've been through it, you've witnessed the reality, as opposed to just imagining it.
Right. No, and I imagined all sorts of scenarios that are actually playing out now that we've had 4 or 5 days of battle. We've seen how many things can go wrong, from ambushes and false surrenders to prisoners of war being mistreated. We haven't really had a true ground war since Vietnam, and we're starting to see how messy, and I think the Secretary Rumsfeld used the word untidy, war can be. My book was certainly about that other side of war that we don't talk about, like what happens when you lay down your arms and become a prisoner, and all the other circumstances of war that don't sort of fit into the kind of clean portrait and the heroic portrait of war that we're used to seeing. So yes, I think certainly the chemical weapons are, I think, their main power over us is fear of the unknown, the uncertainty of what might be coming. I've heard them called Saddam's boogeyman weapons. He may or may not actually have them in a capacity to use them. He may not have delivery systems, but just the fact that he has them and the fact that these chemical weapons are horrible, I think preyed on all of our, on all of us. And you just start imagining VX or sarin gas. You start thinking about all these things could happen. In fact, the odds of them actually happen, I think, are quite small. They're not; these weapons are not very good. They tactically are not a smart weapon. The odds are very, very slim that Saddam would successfully be able to use them and employ them in any way. And yet, we all, all of our thoughts were kind of trained on all these chemical possibilities.
Well, why did you want to cover the war to begin with?
Well, I think that this is a moment in our history where we're going to see the tectonic plates shift. And I'm a historian. This is almost like a front row seat to history. I don't think this is like other wars and other police actions that we've had. This is the real thing. And the consequences of this war and the repercussions are going to be felt for years and decades to come, and so I knew when I got this assignment late in the game that I really wanted to see this unfold in some way. I've quickly found I was a little over my head in terms of this specific embed assignment I got, but I knew I wanted to be here. This is history happening, and it's happening on so many different levels, and it's such a complicated war with so much world opinion mounted against us that I knew that I wanted to be here to witness it.
Hampton Sides speaking to us from Qatar in an interview recorded earlier today. Sides is contributing to the online magazine Slate and reporting for Men's Journal. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Hampton Sides, who is in Qatar reporting on CENTCOM.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview we recorded earlier with journalist Hampton Sides, who's in Qatar covering Central Command. That's not the way he'd planned to spend the war. He was training to be an embedded reporter, but when he got to the gas mask and chemical warfare suit, he realized this wasn't for him. Now he's beginning a journal for Slate, the online magazine, and is reporting for Men's Journal. I asked him what he's been doing in between covering Central Command press conferences.
Well, for many journalists, this has proved to be kind of an Alcatraz sentence. It is for the first several weeks there were absolutely no press conferences, and there was kind of an information famine. Everybody was going out to this place, which has been built out in the middle of the desert. I don't know if you saw the movie Capricorn One, but it reminds me of that. Just sort of this huge hangar built out in the middle of literal and figurative nowhere, where suddenly you open the door and there's lights and there's a set and there's this kind of sense of computers humming and clocks set to Greenwich Mean Time and, you know, this high tech center in the middle of nowhere. So we'd go out there and just twiddle our thumbs and wait for something to happen and wait and wait and wait, and then finally everything happened 2 days ago when General Tommy Franks gave his first conference, and we've been all extremely busy ever since because, you know, the war is happening. There's a million stories to run down, and yet we're also frustrated because it's become quite apparent that a central command, a central clearinghouse for information, is kind of an increasingly obsolete idea. You don't need that for news gathering when you have reporters embedded all over the place. You have unilateral reporters everywhere. You have news coming from Baghdad, you know, live. You have everyone on satellite phones and video phones and video compression, which has allowed us to see all these images, you know, from multiple vantage points, as it's happening. I think it's kind of made Central Command not nearly as important as it would otherwise have been.
Have you been watching TV a lot and watching the embedded reporters?
Yes, and a lot of people are, you know, getting their information from television and then, you know, hopefully trying to find a way to confirm that at Central Command. But outside of the Central Command the main room there is a bank of five different TVs, and they're set to, you know, Fox and CNN and the BBC, and we're all kind of triangulating our information by watching television and then asking each other, and then finally, you know, when these press conferences occur, as one happened just a few hours ago, we're trying to refine this a little bit and get the best and most up-to-date information.
What are your impressions of the quality of information that you're getting from Central Command?
Well, General Franks has been very, he's in a lot of ways the direct opposite of Secretary Rumsfeld. He doesn't give a lot of information. If you really look at what he's saying, we don't know, we're going to find out in the days ahead. I have no idea. In a way, that's comforting. That he's not speculating, and it's rare for a four-star general to go on national television and say, "I don't know." On the other hand, it's very frustrating because, you know, he has a lot of information and he has a lot of access to just unbelievable amounts of information that's coming through his command there, and yet, we leave these conferences quite frustrated. You know, we really haven't learned very much. He says that we're not surprised by anything that we're seeing. He's saying that, you know, the plan is marching ahead, and we're on course, and we'll see what happens in the days ahead. And you know, journalists, I think, get frustrated with that sort of information. I think he's just being very discreet and very prudent, and hopefully these press conferences will get a little bit more, the quality of the information will get better as the days go on.
Where are you staying? Are you staying in a hotel?
Staying in a hotel here, the lovely Marriott, and heading out to CENTCOM, which is inconveniently located about 12 miles south of town in the middle of the desert, and this is Qatar is an interesting place. You know, it's a tiny postage stamp country that is actually feels in some ways more like India or Pakistan, because over 2/3 of the population are expatriate workers from India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, who basically make the country work. And you know, everything from the cab drivers to most of the restaurants and all the domestics are from another country. And so we hop into a cab. Invariably, it'll be a Pakistani cab driver, and we'll head over to CENTCOM and go through what sometimes takes over an hour of security. There's dogs sniffing for bombs, and there's all kinds of you know, searching of your bags. There's an X-ray machine. Then you get on a little shuttle bus and go just like 300 or 400 yards, but for some reason they make us all get on this little shuttle bus and enter this airplane hangar, which if you saw it, you would assume it was just a storage facility, a prefabricated metal warehouse. You would never think it was anything special until you walk inside and realize that this is really the nerve center for this gigantic war that's going on in this theater.
And when you get back to the hotel at night, I mean, do they turn down your covers and turn on the radio for you and put chocolates on your bed? I mean, what's the kind of disconnect between the hotel and the war you're covering?
Yeah, well, there is a lot of disconnect, and it makes it quite surreal for the journalist here because, you know, you're fairly well pampered here. I mean, there's people who, I mean, you know, like they won't allow you to serve yourself or, you know, I mean, this isn't a particularly fancy hotel, and yet there's just legions of people who come and remove your banana from, you know, your banana peel from your plate the second it hits the plate. You know, there's just an unbelievable service sector here of people from India, Pakistan, also the Philippines, and so everyone here is pampered and feeling somewhat maybe guilty about that. Many of the journalists are staying over at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, you know, a 5-star hotel that's frequented mostly by you know, Indonesian businessmen and sheiks, and is owned by the emir here. So there's just this kind of odd sense of we're covering this horrible war and yet going back to these, you know, these wonderful hotels, which, and you know, they also have bars here, which is in the hotels are allowed to serve alcohol in a country that is otherwise dry. It's very difficult to find, you know, to get a drink. There's certainly no bars anywhere but the hotels, and you know, it's like it's two different worlds that you know, you just kind of leave one and go to the other, and then come back.
My guest is journalist Hampton Sides. He's in Qatar, where he's covering Central Command. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the conversation we recorded earlier today with Hampton Sides, a journalist who's now in Qatar covering Central Command. What do you do in between briefings?
Well, there's a lot of there are a lot of other stories to track down here. Also, Al Jazeera, the Arab CNN, so to speak, is based here, and I've been talking to some of the Al Jazeera folks. Running down stories in various places. I'm actually trying to get out. Apparently, there's some world-class dunes here that a number of the journalists who are bored out of their minds in the morning are trying to figure out something to do, and we're going out to these dunes in a four-wheel drive. There's also Qatar. There's a fairly large culture of falconry, the sport of the sheiks, you know, people who participate in this sport of falconry, and there's a number of journalists who are going out to look at some of these falconry exhibitions. So there's a little of everything to do here, but you know, now that the war is really on in earnest, we're pretty busy.
You mentioned Al Jazeera being headquartered in Qatar. Have you spoken to any of the journalists from that network?
I have, and I've spoken to their spokesperson about it, and they're right now in the eye of the storm because of their decision to run this horrible footage. I don't even know if it's been available in the States, but they have aired it here on some of the channels, and you can get Al Jazeera here in the hotel, and it's despicable. I mean, it really makes you wonder what was going through their minds, especially a station like Al Jazeera, which has tried to really make the case that they are a modern and objective network. This sort of set them back.
This is footage of dead American soldiers that you're talking about.
Yes, the footage of the POWs and of the dead soldiers that looks like they had been executed. It's not absolutely clear, but they show their faces and they show their uniforms and make a very concerted effort to show the identity of the dead soldiers, and it's a really horrible thing, and they're defending it in part by saying that it's news because Iraqi television has been airing it and has been making a lot of this but I don't, none of the answers really are ringing true to me. It's very difficult to understand why they're doing this, and it's not just been one airing, it's been airing constantly, you know, for 2 days now.
What have been the reactions of people from Qatar to the broadcast of this film or tape?
Well, my main exposure is really to the cab drivers who are appalled by it. They are also appalled by the war. This country is only nominally, supportive of this effort. I mean, it's being, you know, the whole war is essentially based here in their tiny country, but I would say most of the people are opposed, many not quite violently so, but vehemently so. So they're opposed to the war, I think that most people here think that, you know, this the repeated broadcast of these images over and over again is, you know, they're appalled by it like everyone else.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'd like to hear more about the reactions you're getting from people who you meet in Qatar. You say it's mostly taxi drivers, but mm-hmm. you know, people apparently are opposed to the war, yet there's all these Westerners there to cover the war. So is that opposition to the war being directed at you and other Americans in a personal way? Are you getting a sense of hostility?
No, I would not say so. They're journalists here from so many countries, from all over the world, and I think the locals here understand that this is a world event happening on their doorstep, and they're not taking it out on the journalists. At the same time, you know, they were not allowed. This is not a democracy, and the decision to base this have CENTCOM come here was fundamentally the decision of the emir. And a lot of times these locals are just sort of, it's dawning on them as the week unfolds just how huge an operation is here and just how intricately their country's fate is tied up in this war. And I've noticed as the week has gone on that they're a little bit more and more confused and troubled by it. They're certainly, overwhelmingly opposed to the war, even if they recognize that Saddam Hussein is a tyrant, perhaps was. I think he's still alive. They're opposed to Saddam Hussein, but they just don't see this war as being anything that they want their country involved in.
Hampton, one more thing.
That's markedly different from Kuwait. You know, Kuwait was invaded by Iraq, and the locals in Kuwait are overwhelmingly supportive. And although there are foreign workers there that are opposed, Kuwaitis have very vivid memories of 91 and are very loyal to the Americans and very, very pleased that this is all finally happening. But in Doha and Qatar, the reaction is somewhat different in that way.
You know, we're talking on a terrific phone line. I've had phone lines from New York that are much worse than this. It's a great phone line. Is that representative of the level of technology in Qatar?
It's a very well-oiled and well-wired society. Things work here, you know. Just the infrastructure of this country is quite extraordinary for a place that, you know, most people have never even heard of, and which is in a part of the world where often the phones don't work, let's face it. So suddenly things don't work. You find that, you know, it's like there is kind of a veneer of high tech, but underneath that, this phone, for example, you know, it's a great phone line, but I've been talking on the phone doing some other interviews when suddenly, just for inexplicably, you know, the phone goes dead. So I don't know. It's high tech, and yet it's also an almost feudal society that's, you know, run by an emir who has absolute control and has four, some believe five, at least four wives, and women have very limited rights here. They can't vote. They can drive, which is at least a start. And it's a very conservative, in some respects, feudal society. So there's kind of an unusual degree of modernity here and tolerance. They allow alcohol here in hotels and limited places. But at the same time, it's in some ways feels like it's just one or two steps away from being a Bedouin society. When you go out into the desert, it's almost like you've gone back 200 years in time.
When you were going to be an embedded reporter, you were going to be doing that for Men's Journal. I confess, I don't even know the magazine, but it's not in the upper ranks of news magazines. Were you kind of treated any differently because you were representing Men's Journal than you would have been if you were representing, say, the New York Times or the New Yorker, you know, Time, Newsweek?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely not. Most of the Marines and the other armed forces had heard and were avid readers of the magazine.
I guess they're men, and I'm not. That might have something to do with it.
Right. And I don't think that ended up being a factor. I thought it might, but it's not at all. I'm big fans of the magazine.
Well, Hampton Sides, thank you so much. Good luck to you. Thank you for your time talking with us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on the show. I do appreciate it.
Hampton Sides recorded earlier today from Qatar, where he's covering Central Command. He's contributing to Slate and reporting for Men's Journal. Sides is also the author of the World War II book, Ghost Soldiers. Well, it's officially spring, but the season isn't bringing the joy it's famous for. Here's a spring song with a somber tone, Frank Lesser's Spring Is Here, sung by Abby Lincoln.
A little late this year, a little late arriving in our lonely world over here, 'cause you continues cold, as if to say, spring it's merely that spring will be little late this year.
Abby Lincoln singing Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a CD by a band that does covers of Rodgers and Hart, Julie Stein, and others. This is Fresh Air. We're going to lighten things up for a couple of minutes and hear about a band our rock critic Ken Tucker likes a lot that just released The Party's Over by the Smoking Popes. Was recorded in 1998, shortly before the band broke up. The pop rock group had a cult following and even inspired a tribute album. Ken says the Popes' final release is worth being heard by a wider audience.
7 lonely days make one lonely. 7 lonely nights make one lonely me. Ever since the time you told me we were through, 7 lonely days I cried and I cried for you. Oh, my darling, I'm crying. Boo hoo hoo. Ain't no use in denying. I cried for you. What's your favorite pastime?
Everything good and worth saluting about the Smoking Popes, who broke up in 1998, can be heard in the lead-off cut to The Party's Over. The Smoking Popes singer-guitarist Josh Caterer takes a fairly obscure country song, 7 Lonely Days, a hit for the female vocalist Jean Shepherd in 1969, and first of all does a beautiful, forceful rendition of it. But he also imbues it with a quality that distinguished the Smoking Popes' career throughout the 90s, a kind of sensitive assertiveness, the advancement of wimpiness as a virtue.
I'm wild again, beguiled again, a whimpering, simpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered.
The Smoking Popes, moving gently through Rodgers and Hart. The Party's Over is a collection of such unlikely covers, including composers ranging from Comden and Green to Kris Kristofferson. This is an entirely atypical project. On their other albums, this Illinois band, led by three brothers, Josh, Matt, and Eli Caterer, recorded a few albums of their own post-punk rock and ballads that earned them a cult following, a brief stint on Capitol Records, and spots on tours as the opening act for at least two artists whose musical styles they uncannily cross, Green Day and Morrissey. The Popes' sound was most characteristic of the kind of punchy pop energy they give this album's title song.
The party's over. It's time to call it a day. They burst your pretty balloon. The piper must be paid. The party's over.
It's a bit ironic that one of the reasons the Smoking Popes, with their potentially offensive band name, broke up is that one of the Caterer brothers, Josh, found religion and broke away to make more spiritual music with a band he formed called Duval, which makes the Pope's 1998 cover of the gospel standard Farther Along all the more prophetic.
Tempted and tried, we're oft made to wonder why it should be thus all the day long, while there are others living around us, never molested, rolling along. Farther along, we don't know all about it. Farther
over the past 5 years or so, there's been a small revival or reinvention of terrific pop rock music that rarely gets noticed in the music industry, with acts like Fountains of Wayne, Brendan Benson, Apples in Stereo, Supergrass, and yes, the Smoking Popes, creating smart, fast, loud, melodic music that is at once thrillingly accessible and heartbreakingly obscure. The Smoking Popes attracted enough of a following that their demise has inspired a new album called Tribute, covers of Pope's songs by even more obscure bands than them. It's heartfelt stuff, but like virtually all tribute albums, aimless and pretty worthless. Better to pick up on the CDs by the Popes themselves, or this worthy epitaph for a band that never received its proper due.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the just-released final album by the Smoking Popes. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our examination of the war in Iraq and the history leading up to it. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.